Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 15th of November. Our guest this hour writes in his book, Remedy in Action. Actually, it's the first sentence in his book. Among the rich nations of the world, the United States stands out for the virulence of its political battles over health care. And even though the Affordable Care Act is going forward, there are still debates about this. As you know, tomorrow is the deadline for states to submit declaration letters indicating intent to establish a state-based health insurance exchange. We don't know what Wisconsin will do. We haven't heard from officials here in the state. So that is yet to be determined. But we are going to look this hour at how we move ahead with affordable care. Also, Governor Walker is deciding whether or not to create a state health care exchange. He also, I don't know if you saw this article in the Journal Sentinel a couple days ago, will have to contend in the coming legislative session with nine lawmakers who've said that they back a bill to arrest any federal officials who try to implement the health care law. So the debate continues, but affordable care is going forward, and we thought it was a good day to learn more about how it is going forward, starting with the state-based health insurance exchanges. We have a guest who's very knowledgeable about all of this, Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public affairs and professor of communications at public affairs at Princeton University, co-founder of the American Prospect, author of a number of books. He received a Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction, and that was for the social transformation of American medicine. His latest book, which looks very extensively at the battle over health care in this country, is Remedy and Reaction, the Peculiar American Struggle Over Health Care Reform. We get a lot of calls when we're on this topic, and it's important time to talk about this. Here's how you reach our conversation this morning, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Paul Starr, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Kathleen.
Bring us up to speed on what has to happen tomorrow, the deadline for the states to give their declaration letters.
Well, I don't actually think tomorrow is going to be that critical a deadline. There's really a more important deadline coming up in January when states really have to show if they've indicated that they want to proceed with a state-based exchange. They're going to have to show that they're going to be able to do it because that exchange would have to be up and running by next fall, next October, for open enrollment in the new plans that will be offered as of January 1st, 2014. And the big problem for states that have delayed, typically these are states with Republican leadership that have been opposed to the law, is that, well, you know, now the deadlines are coming and they haven't done the groundwork that they could have been doing for the last couple of years. And so it may be very difficult, even where there are some states where I think there is the will to go ahead, but they've lost so much time that they are going to abdicate and have the federal government do it.
Mm-hmm. And would it behoove a state to do its own exchange?
Well, I think the advantage from the public's point of view is the potential for having greater coordination between the new state exchange and other state programs like Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program. The idea in the law is that people who are applying for benefits, trying to determine whether they're eligible, won't have to figure out which door they go to. There's supposed to be one door, some kind of online system where people can go, put in their information, and the system will determine whether they're eligible for Medicaid or for a subsidy in the exchange or perhaps the Children's Insurance Program or something else. But take the burden off the applicants, make things simpler from the public's point of view. That's one of the ideas here. And I think that's going to be easier to do if a state takes full responsibility. But my great worry here is that with so much resistance in the states, many of them will not really have their heart in it, will not really be committed to it, and will not do a good job.
Mm-hmm. And tell me more about these exchanges. Who would be going to the exchange? Everybody or not?
Okay. Let's just take a step back
right.
and get a sense of the whole concept of this law. So the first thing is, you know, under insurance today, private insurance today, if you're an individual and you're looking for insurance, if you have a pre-existing condition, if you've got a medical history, if there's somebody in your family with that history, you may not be able to get any insurance at all. Mm-hmm. You may just get turned down. Or you may be offered a price that you can't afford, because insurers can price the plans according to your medical condition. That's not going to be possible now. That's the one of the most important things the law changes. There are so many people out there who do have a history like that, who do have somebody in their family and have been cut out of insurance or are paying exorbitant prices. They're going to benefit tremendously from this new system. Then there are subsidies for people with low incomes. Now, there are two kinds of things here. One is the expansion of the Medicaid program to people whose incomes are under the poverty line or just a third above the poverty line. Poverty level for an individual in the United States is this year is $11,170. And so people with incomes up to about $15,000 would be eligible for Medicaid. This is going to be a national standard. There hasn't been a national standard, and frankly, there are many states that have kept eligibility for Medicaid so restricted that people, you know, way down at incomes of $3,000-$4,000 haven't been able to qualify in
those
states. So this is the first time we'll have a national standard for Medicaid. But then for people with incomes just above that level, there are going to be tax credits, subsidies that you can get with a plan in the exchange. The exchange is a system for offering private insurance plans. So this is a really important aspect of the law, and I think it's extremely important for conservatives to recognize that they won this argument. They won this argument. If you go back over the last half century, what liberals wanted was a federal insurance system like the original Medicare plan. They didn't get that.
Mm-hmm.
Then in this latest debate, liberals also wanted a public option, that is a federal insurance plan that would be an option along with private insurance plans. Well, they didn't get that either. The only plans in the exchange are private insurance plans. Conservatives won that. This is actually the exchanges that are going to be developed really come out of a whole history of conservative proposals. So they should be able to live with this idea very, very easily.
Mm-hmm.
So there are going to be different insurance plans, private insurance plans offered in the exchange, and they're going to be offered on a range from platinum, gold, silver, down to bronze. And what all those refer to are the levels of coverage. And the subsidies that people get are not extravagant. Those subsidies are pegged to the second lowest cost level of coverage, the silver level of coverage. And what that means is it's not really spectacularly generous. It means that about 30% of the cost on average will still be paid by the consumer out of pocket, although there is an out-of-pocket limit on the plans. So there's coverage for very high cost situations. So people will get subsidies to enroll in those plans, and the subsidies are set on a kind of sliding scale basis to limit the proportion of your income that has to go for health insurance. And it depends. If you're down near the poverty line, it would just be about 3% of income. So, for example, for somebody who makes $16,000 a year, the annual premium would be about $500. That's $40-something dollars a month.
Mm-hmm.
But that goes up as people's income goes up. Their cost for the premium would also go up. And the limit for people at four times the poverty level is about 9% of income going to pay for the premium. This is complicated. I wish it were simpler. But the idea here is to make insurance affordable. That is the key idea, so that we don't have a situation where there are, as there are today, millions of people who are priced out of the insurance market, who would like to have coverage But there's just no way they can afford it. This will make it possible for them to afford it. Mm-hmm. But most of the people are not getting it for free. They are going to have to pay for it.
Now, tell me how most of us get our insurance from our employers. Is there some kind of interaction between employers and these health insurance exchanges, or are these exchanges for people whose employers are not covering their health care?
This is primarily for people who don't have insurance, but very small businesses are almost really in the same situation as individuals applying for coverage. I just saw a survey from the Gallup organization just this past week. It was a survey of entrepreneurs, and I was struck that one of every four in the United States is uninsured, has no health insurance, which is just astonishing. But, you know, if you're in a small business, it's tough to get affordable insurance. These exchanges are going to be a great deal for you. So small businesses are also going to be involved in it, and there are tax credits also to help the small businesses.
And we've heard a lot about businesses not being able to afford this in the news this week. There have been people who have said, well, even for the election, you know, if you vote for the Democrats, you can't do this. We're going to have to cut some of your jobs. We can't afford health care. Factor in all of those complaints.
Uh-huh. Well, there have been studies on both sides. I don't believe the arguments that this is going to cost jobs. There is no employer mandate in this law. Employers are not required to offer coverage. Now, for larger employers with, I think, more than 50 employees, if they do face a penalty if some of their employees end up subsidized under this law. They have to pay a penalty for, if they have no employees who get subsidies, no problem. But if they are essentially leaving the costs entirely to the government, there is a penalty. So there is an encouragement for employers to cover their workers, but it's not a requirement. There's no employer mandate in the law.
Mm-hmm. Tell me all that the law will do. We've had a phase-in of the first part of the law, which people seem to appreciate and enjoy. What will we see in the coming years?
Okay, well, as you've indicated, some of the provisions went into effect pretty quickly, some actually late in 2010 after the law was enacted. For example, the requirement that children up to age 26 be able to stay on their parents' policies. That's one of the aspects of the law that's had a big impact. Probably more than 2 million young adults have gotten coverage that way. And I noticed just yesterday that Mitt Romney said that one of the reasons that he lost the election was because of the, quote, gifts that Obama had given. And he particularly mentioned young adults and this provision for coverage of young adults under their parents' policies. But that really is, it's an enormously popular provision, and it's had very slight impact on health insurance rates. So there are a whole bunch of other things that are coming into effect. January 1st, 2014 is the day when most of this happens, and that's the expansion of coverage in Medicaid and the establishment of the exchanges and the coverage under the exchanges. Mm-hmm. If things all went well, there'd be some 30 million additional people who would get health insurance coverage at that point. But the Supreme Court has said that states do not have to expand their Medicaid plans, and many of the states with Republican leadership will not do so. And so instead of having 30 million or more people covered, the number will be lower depending on how many states refuse to expand Medicaid. I'm also concerned, actually, also about the exchanges because of the resistance and the tardiness in doing the work to set them up. And here's another problem. So there was a recent survey that indicated that 78% of the people who will have new opportunities for health insurance under the law are unaware that they will have those opportunities. The great majority of the people out there, these are mostly low-wage workers. They're also people with pre-existing medical conditions. But apparently three-quarters of them don't realize that they can get coverage under this new law as of 2014. And really, you know, I don't blame them. It's been very uncertain whether the law was going to be carried out. The Supreme Court might have struck it down. The Republicans might have repealed it. Now, neither of those is going to happen. The law is going ahead. But people still don't understand what the law has to offer them. And the result is that there may not be as many people who sign up for coverage when it becomes available.
So whose job is it to do a public education component?
Okay, so here's another problem. There's no money in the legislation for public education. There's no federal money. And many of the states are not going to spend any money. So it's a good question. Who's going to do the public education? Well, some organizations have come together under a new organization called Enroll America, which has support from some of the hospitals, other medical providers. They have a great interest in seeing people sign up for insurance, because if they have insurance, then they won't leave bad debt at the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And so at this point, they've put very little money into this effort, into this organization, Enroll America. There's going to have to be a lot more done to educate the public about it. One of the reasons Massachusetts was successful under Governor Romney is that they did put money into public education. In fact, they had the stars from the Boston Red Sox doing ads.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, and in Massachusetts, that's just about the best thing you could possibly have to publicize a new program. You know, there need to be similar efforts around the country if this thing is really going to get going.
Well, this time thing that you mentioned earlier, if you have to have exchanges ready to be starting to sign people up and businesses as well by next October, that's less than a year away. That's not very much time. And you would like to have, I would assume, some kind of public hearings to determine what the public would like. I guess states don't need to have that, but we're talking not much time here.
Yeah, there's been over 2 years. I mean, Massachusetts actually got its exchange up and running in 4 months. The Medicare program back in 1965, it went into effect in less than 1 year in 1966.
Oh.
It is actually possible to do things more quickly. We have all the communications technology with the Internet and all sorts of new media. We can do it, but there has to be the commitment. It's not really a problem of carrying out these things in a short time. It's a problem of getting people to put their effort behind it.
Now, this is a side story, but I must ask you about it because it certainly caught my attention in the newspaper just a couple days ago. He's going to have to contend, our governor, in the coming legislative session with 9 lawmakers who've said that they back a bill, this is incredible, to arrest any federal officials who try to implement the health care law.
Yeah, I'm afraid we settled that in the Civil War. State officials cannot arrest federal officials for carrying out a law.
Okay, enough said. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our guest, Professor Paul Starr, is a professor of sociology and public affairs and professor of communications and public affairs at Princeton University. He has written a valuable history titled Remedy and Reaction, The Peculiar American Struggle Over Health Care Reform. As Wisconsin is, we're awaiting a decision as to whether or not we're going to submit a declaration letter indicating an intent to establish state-based health insurance exchanges. The deadline for that, the intent, is tomorrow. There is a little more time for details on that intent. What do you think about all of this? Our phone number, how much do you know about the healthcare exchanges? How much do you know about the law? What will be coming into implementation in the next couple of years? How do we all learn about this? We welcome your phone calls, and we have a ton of emails coming in as well. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And let's start with an email. Ruth and Ladysmith emailed, I hope many states do not set up their own program, because if the federal government sets up their programs, it will be easier to connect those programs into one federal single-payer program. This is the only sensible way to provide health care insurance and cut out the waste of profits being given to executives in ridiculous pay packages.
Well, this is not remotely a single-payer program. So let's just explain this. By single payer, most people refer to a single governmental insurance plan like the traditional Medicare program. But there is no governmental insurance plan under the Affordable Care Act. It is the exchange is a mechanism for buying private insurance. So it's not going to help whether it's a federal exchange or a state exchange.
But if you move toward a public system, which, you know, that's another story, that's another 50 hours of talk show conversation. If you have a system in place that the federal government has set up in these states, more states go that route, does it make it easier to convert to a public payer system or not?
Let me mention something else. There is one role that the federal government does have in the exchanges. There are going to be two plans in every state exchange that are going to be negotiated by the federal government, that are going to be negotiated by the Office of Personnel Management that runs the Federal Employees Health Benefit Plan. And so in that sense, these plans, however, are going to be offered by private insurers, but they'll be federally negotiated. That's the one aspect of federal participation in the exchanges. There are also, let me just say, there are some very important questions about the design of these exchanges. And the single biggest question is whether the exchange is just a clearinghouse listing private plans, or whether the exchange is a negotiator. Mm. And that is the key thing. Now, Massachusetts negotiates aggressively with the private insurers. And if they can't come to terms, then a private insurer does not get to be listed on the exchange. And the exchange of Massachusetts has used its muscle, because of the very considerable number of enrollees, to help control the rates.
Mm-hmm.
But a state that just acts as a clearinghouse will not be doing that, will not be exercising the leverage that the exchange potentially provides.
Mm. Will the federal government, though?
No, this is up to the states.
Okay.
This decision has been left to the states, and I think what we will see is that in the blue states, the exchanges act as negotiators. But in the states with Republican leadership, they will mostly just be clearinghouses. And we will get to see what the result is of those two kinds of organization.
Oh, interesting. Susan in Coon Valley, hi.
Good morning. I have a question regarding the Enroll America or Educate America. Two concerns. First of all, we have a governor that really does not want to implement this. And secondly, when people go, or people, you know, some people do not have access to computers, so they can go to a public library, they can pull up insurance plans on the computer. But, you know, there's nothing simple about doing this. So how are people going to be educated to know how to sign up when they can access these various insurance plans on the computer?
You have raised the crucial question, especially, I think, in states where there isn't a commitment by the state government to carry out a public education campaign. You can actually go online to the Massachusetts Health Connector, and it's pretty simple. It's really sort of like using one of the online travel sites, you know, like Expedia or Orbitz or whatever, to get a flight or a hotel room. You put in your information, and the system does most of the work. That's the way it should be set up, and it would be very helpful for local libraries and other agencies to have people available who can help others get through this step by step.
Thank you so much for your call, Susan. Dave in Oregon. Hi, Dave.
Good morning.
Good morning.
One of the things that I feel is left out of the whole conversation here is the fact that health care is so expensive, and I don't really hear anything about anyone doing anything to drive the costs of health care down, other than forcing insurance companies to negotiate prices with providers. In addition, I'll admit that I am a licensed insurance agent. I spend a lot of time helping clients figure out what is going to work best for them with respect to health insurance. How are the exchanges going to do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, let's face it, I mentioned the similarity between the exchanges and those online travel sites like Expedia. Not much business left for travel agents once people learned how to use those sites online. So insurance agents are not very happy about the prospect of having simple online sites where people can sign up for insurance. But that's where we need to move. Frankly, one of the objectives of this law is to cut down on the huge administrative overhead that makes healthcare so expensive in the United States. The bureaucratic overhead in this system is much greater than in other countries with more unified or standardized systems. And one of the objectives of the exchanges is to cut out some of the costs of intermediaries, and I'm afraid insurance agents are part of the problem, not the answer.
This is not part of the Affordable Care Act, but I'm wondering, this is just kind of a side issue that may be important because some doctors are complaining about this. In January, Medicare fees to physicians are scheduled to be reduced by 27% unless there is an intervention by Congress. This is not covered by the Affordable Care Act. It is related to lowering health care costs, but that's another debate on the horizon here.
Yeah, that is a separate issue. So this all goes back to a 1997 provision that was adopted as part of a balanced budget agreement at that time, in which there were supposed to be adjustments of Medicare fees if the volume of Medicare services increased above a target level. Congress has never carried out the fee reductions. Every time this comes up, Congress figures out a way to leave fees at their previous level. So my guess is this will be part of the final budget negotiations, and it's a periodic issue that comes up.
Mm-hmm. And isn't there something, Paul, that deals with it changes kind of a philosophy of how healthcare places are reimbursed? That we're going from pay per service to a different kind of system, to more of a lump sum of money for a patient's care? Am I wrong about that?
Well, we have been talking about alternatives to fee-for-service for 30, 40 years in this country. And we've gone through a series of different options. Health maintenance organizations have been the single most important alternative to fee-for-service. So there is no one big step in this law in that direction. There are, however, some demonstration projects, experiments in the Medicare program. And these involve, let me just give you an example, the bundling of payments for episodes of hospital care. So instead of Medicare paying for each separate service in the hospital and for the services leading up to a hospitalization and afterward, those are all going to be bundled together in a single payment to a hospital, also for the pre-admission and post-admission care. And the idea here is to create incentives for the hospital to provide the most efficient and high-quality care possible. Hospitals are now going to be penalized for excessive rates of readmission for complications after surgery, for example. And so the idea is to improve on the kinds of incentives that have existed, because right now, hospitals have actually made more money if they do a bad job and you have to get readmitted afterwards because of complications. Mm-hmm. That seems nuts.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we're trying to figure out ways to do this more efficiently and to give the providers incentives to do things better.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email from Judy in Green Bay. Let me get my screen figured out here. Sorry. I work for a hospital, and I've had to discuss payment options with many people. The insurance exchange is a godsend for hospitals. Commercial insurance is really the only profitable income for hospitals, as Medicare pays below cost and medical assistance isn't much better. This new exchange is going to save hospitals and therefore health care availability for people.
Uh-huh. Well, at this point, and I think it's especially true in the northern Midwest, Medicare payments are significantly below private insurance payments, and that has been one of the major obstacles to extending Medicare to people under age 65, because many hospitals and other providers say that's a real threat to them because they wouldn't get paid enough to operate. So they are much happier to see the expansion of the exchanges with private insurance because private insurance pays them better.
Mm, interesting.
So that's, you know, essentially the compromise that was worked out in this law. There's an expansion for Medicaid for the poor, and Medicaid doesn't pay the hospitals very well either. But for people above that level, it's private insurance, and the hospitals are much more satisfied with that arrangement.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Dave, for the call. Rick in Gays Mills. Hi.
Good morning. I have a question as to whether the following behavior is either prohibited, addressed, or penalized in the Affordable Care Act. And the behavior is the following. Two examples. There was a huge article in the Sunday Chicago Tribune about a guy who had emergency care for a spine fracture and then had $17,000 dumped on him. And he had to go through great protests. And, oh, yes, the insurance company said, yes, we're responsible for it. We'll pay it. A procedure that's pre-certified, and the insurance company says they'll pay for it, and then the bill comes, the insurance company says denied, and you go back and you argue with them, and you say you pre-certified, and say, oh, yes, we did, okay, we'll pay for it. So this tricky behavior, is it addressed or penalized or in some way prohibited in the Affordable Care Act?
Well, it sounds like, to be honest, it sounds like what that insurance company did was already prohibited by law. I'm not sure there's any new provision that addresses it, but if they had pre-certified it, if they had acknowledged that it was covered, and then they refused to pay, it sounds to me like that's a breach of contract.
Here's an email from Lawrence who says, all Obamacare does is provide a way for the federal government to tax the poor, literally a poor tax. I make about $20,000 a year and don't buy insurance because I can't afford it. I have to pay rent and buy food. Obamacare does nothing to lower the cost of insurance. It charges me a yearly tax of about $600, and I still won't have health insurance.
Well, it does lower the cost of insurance for that person who's got an income of $20,000. It decidedly lowers it. That person would be getting a very significant subsidy through the exchange. So this is just an example of where people don't have good information yet, and I hope that as the law gets implemented, when we have open enrollment in the fall of 2013, people will actually see, oh, yeah, I can get insurance at a reasonable price.
Sherry in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. My question is, the first part is, how does this affect people on Medicaid?
How does it affect people on Medicaid? Well,
yes.
If they are currently on Medicaid, I don't think it does affect them very greatly.
Okay. Well, that's a good thing. And the second part of this was, Scott Walker, you know, is a Republican, as everybody knows, and his views are set toward that frame of mind. And, I mean, what does he mean? He's not going to allow our state. It's like he's not the speaker of myself, and I'm sure there's many others that don't agree with him. So as a people of Wisconsin, how can we allow him to talk for us if it's going to benefit people? And what can we do about it to stop him?
Well, I can't address that. I'm not from Wisconsin. That's I don't know the local political situation there. Kathleen, maybe it's a question for you to answer.
Well, I don't know what the answer is to that, and it's not just Wisconsin. You do wonder politically how this is going to play out, because you have a number of, as we've talked about, Republican legislatures and Republican governors who aren't crazy about this legislation. It is the law of the land, and they will have to do something, but I don't know. We have yet to see. It would be nice to have some public discussion about all of this, because it is going to happen now. No matter where you are politically, it is happening at this point. It's been through all the tests, right? So I don't know. I don't know what will happen.
Well, let's be clear. The exchanges will happen because the law has a fallback provision.
Right.
If a state doesn't carry it out, the federal government will.
Right.
But the Medicaid expansion will not necessarily happen.
Right.
Because if a state refuses, then there will be no expansion of coverage for low-income people who are now not eligible.
Right. And that's probably just the way it will be, because there are people whose views have been stated. And we know what they are. And so you can't imagine a Medicaid expansion happening in the state of Wisconsin at this point in time.
Well, let me just explain something about that. So for the first 3 years under the law, from 2014 to 2017, 100% of the cost of the newly eligible Medicaid beneficiaries is paid for by the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And it then goes down to 90%. So almost all that money is going to come from the federal government, and very little from the state. Now, there are other changes in the law which are going to adversely affect hospitals and other providers if there is no Medicaid expansion. And let me try to explain this. Under the Medicare law, there is a payment to hospitals that have what's called a disproportionate share of the uninsured. That money comes through the Medicare program. It's been a source of funding for hospitals who have a lot of bad debt, who have a lot of patients who have no health insurance. Well, under the Affordable Care Act, that money is diminishing because, after all, the law is covering more people through Medicaid and the exchanges. So the idea is the federal government shouldn't be paying that additional money to hospitals. So what will happen in a state that doesn't expand Medicaid is many of the hospitals, especially in low-income urban areas and rural areas, many of those hospitals will be plunged into severe difficulty if the state refuses to expand Medicaid.
Mm. And at this point, maybe we can check on this. This is the first of several shows on this. Do you need to have a legislative discussion and vote on whether or not to expand Medicaid, or is it something that...
Oh, yes.
You do. So this will be something that we will be discussing and debating in the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, and let me just explain also. I don't know how much money would come into Wisconsin specifically through the Medicaid expansion. I was just in Missouri, and the Medicaid expansion there would bring into the state about $2 billion a year.
Oh, my.
And that money, of course, would not just go to the hospitals and physicians. It would also go to all of their suppliers, all of the local businesses that benefit indirectly. There'd be a tremendous multiplier effect. This is a very significant issue for the local economy in every state.
Mm-hmm.
So a state that turns down this money is doing damage, is harming its own economy.
So we can only assume that there would be hearings on whatever bill that people would have a chance to have input down the road.
Uh-huh.
All right. Oh, and the beat goes on. Let's welcome more phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Paul Starr. He is a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. He is author of Remedy and Reaction, The Peculiar American Struggle Over Healthcare Reform. Paul won the 1984 Pulitzer Prize for Nonfiction for his book, The Social Transformation of American Medicine. We are welcoming phone calls. We're absolutely flooded. There's obviously a need in the state of Wisconsin to find out where we're going with this and for an educational program to determine what this law will do and how we're responding to it in the state. There's too much information here that we don't know, and We obviously are in need of it. We're flooded with emails and with phone calls on this. We'll do more, I promise. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And just a note to listeners, we've been talking about tomorrow being the deadline for states to submit their declaration letter on health exchanges. There will also be 3 additional months until February of 2013 to decide whether or not to set up the exchange themselves or in partnership with the federal government. As soon as we know where we're going in the state of Wisconsin, we will obviously do probably more than one show to explain all of this to you. Let's go back to phone calls. How about Wayne in Oshkosh? Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Kathleen. Great show as always.
Thanks, Wayne.
Professor Starr, when the governor brings out his exchange plan, what should Wisconsinites be looking for to get a good idea of the quality of the exchange? Are there any telltale signs we should look out for?
Wayne, the thing that I think is most important is whether or not the exchange is going to be able to bargain with the plans over their rates, over various things like their networks. Do they have an adequate number of doctors and hospitals and so forth? It's, I think, very important for consumers to have a representative in the exchange that is acting on their behalf. Let me just also go into another problem. When consumers are presented with a tremendous number of complex options, they often find it impossible to make a decision. It's actually better to have certain standardized alternatives. Now, the exchange is supposed to set up these plans, has to set up these plans in these tiers that I mentioned earlier. At the highest level, the platinum coverage, gold, silver, bronze. And although the subsidies are geared to the second lowest cost plan, people are free to choose any one of them. But it's very important that these be represented clearly and plainly with easy to understand benefit information.
Yes.
These are all things that are required under the law, but it really depends on how well a state carries this out.
Okay.
Okay, Wayne.
Thank you.
It is such a complicated system. It remains complicated even with this act, doesn't it? Would we have something that we could all understand? It's just so hard to get to that, isn't it, Paul?
Well, it is. It is. One of the provisions that's actually already gone into effect in the law is that private insurers are required now to provide a plain language explanation of benefits. You know, ordinary language, not complex insurance terminology. And that is one of the things that I think people appreciate the most. And it's very important, I think, for these exchanges to be able to work.
Mm-hmm. Bev asks or says, we are super excited with the pending implementation of the ACA due to pre-existing conditions. I can't get private insurance unless we stay on my husband's company plan. He's retired, so we pay full freight, $1,261 a month or over $15,000 a year. The CARE Act, Affordable CARE Act, will save us bundles since I can then get private insurance and hubby can get an inexpensive Medicare supplemental plan. Does the governor's reluctance to participate affect our plan changes? We will not need any assistance for the premiums.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can't speak to that person's individual situation. There are a lot of people out there with pre-existing conditions who are now paying very high rates, and they will benefit from a system where there is no. The insurers do not vary the rates according to your individual medical condition. That is crucial.
Tim in La Crosse, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Number one, I just had two quick questions. Number one, the Supreme Court ruled that this was a tax. And my understanding when I talk to other conservatives are that future challenges to this are going to, there will be some problems as a result of them saying that this is a tax. And then my second question is I have a really good health care plan through my job, my employer. And I actually, I travel around a lot to a lot of small grocery stores that are saying that their employees, they're going to be dropping their hours, just like Applebee's and Olive Garden, will be dropping their hours during January 1st because if you work more than, I think, 29 hours, you have to provide insurance, and that's a concern. But more importantly, my concern is I'm hearing that a lot of companies would rather just pay the fine than to provide the insurance. And I get concerned that, and I think it's a very real concern, that like in 2014, my company would rather, because they would save money, is just to pay the fine and all the employees go on into this exchange or, you know, God help us if there's ever a single-payer system. All these large companies out there would just, they would save billions to be able to get rid of their employees' health coverage.
Professor Starr.
I know that's the fear that some people have and many people are stirring. We do have the example of Massachusetts that enacted a very similar law, and instead of fewer employers offering insurance, more employers have offered insurance. And let's go back to why employers offer insurance. They offer insurance coverage to be able to attract employees, and that is, after all, they could drop their insurance now. They could not have provided it to begin with, but they did it in order to attract employees. They will have the same incentive to provide insurance coverage when this law is enacted, and they'll have that incentive because, by and large, the coverage, especially that big employers offer, will continue to be more generous than what most people will buy with the subsidies in the exchange. And so I don't really expect there will be all that significant a shift. There will be some employers that do drop coverage, and there'll be some that add. The best estimates that I've seen suggest that on net, there'll be an increase in employer coverage. Mm.
Another phone call. I can't tell you how flooded we are with people who have questions about this. I guess it's only natural because nobody's been giving complete answers. Lou in Montreal, Wisconsin, a major concern I have about these exchanges being delineated by individual states. If state boundaries are truly followed, it will penalize people like me who live very near a border. My health care providers are across the state line, 3 miles away from my home in Michigan. How will the program address this issue, Paul?
All state, all health insurance regulation has been state-based. That's how our insurance system runs, primarily with state regulations. So I'm not sure, you know, insurance plans have to be licensed under a state. That really isn't going to change. I don't understand why the caller or the writer thinks that this is going to make any difference. The current plan that person has would have been licensed in the state where he lives, I assume, and presumably it covers providers that are located outside the state.
Well, we better stop at this point because we'll never get to everybody. We need to do more shows. But I guess that first sentence of your book comes back, doesn't it, that we stand out for the virulence of our battles over health care, and they keep going on, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Yes, they do. Thank you. You've been a wealth of information. I appreciate your being with us, Paul.
Well, thank you very much, Kathleen.
Thank you. Paul Starr, we'll talk more about this, certainly as soon as we know what's happening in the state of Wisconsin. And we all need more information, right? Paul Starr is a professor of sociology and public affairs, Stewart Professor of Communications and Public Affairs at Princeton University. He is co-founder of the American Prospect, author of Remedy and Reaction, for those of you who want a good book that looks at the whole history of the peculiar American struggle over health care reform. You can find it in his book. He's written many other books as well. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produced this program. Thank you for all of your calls. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of them. We also had a ton of emails, but rest assured we will do further shows on this issue, as we have in the past, right? We've done many, and we'll do many more. News is coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and we will have another hour of conversation looking at foreign travel for students, semester abroad, year abroad, and students coming from abroad to our country.